film class's final projects because they were in the dark room and he turned the lights on.
Oh,
and
no.
Destroyed like 3 months worth of work.
Oh, God. Okay, then.
So mad.
I bet. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that used to happen. And that's why film is... there's so many things in the vaults that deteriorated and so many things that are lost. Okay, I wanted to show you Dante Gabriel Rossetti's painting, The Blessed Damozel. So I thought I could get it up on the screen, but I can't. So that's one of the poems we'll be looking at today. So the poem he wrote when he was 18, and he was thinking of it as a response to Poe. So do you remember The Blessed Damozel? It's like, I know you read a lot for today, or were supposed to have read a lot for today. Do you remember it? The Blessed Damozel, yeah. Okay, so he wrote it when he was 18. He had read The Raven and Annabel Lee. The Poe poems, we talked a little bit about The Raven, remember? I was actually going to bring in the Peric translation of it. Quote that blackbird, not again. Remember, we talked about that. So in The Raven, the speaker of The Raven says, yes, he's never going to see the lost Lenore again. or at least The Raven says he will never see the lost Lenore again. In Annabel Lee, she dies, she's gone forever. So Dante Gabriel Rossetti thought, what if I do a similar poem, but from the woman's point of view, the dead woman's point of view instead of the living, mourning man's point of view. So he wrote The Blessed Damozel when he was 18. And then he painted the painting you just saw 25 years later. The painting itself that you saw doesn't have the words of the poem, but if you actually go see it, it's at Harvard. You can see it in the Fogg Art Museum. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't yet, so I'm going to make a note.
Some of the poem is written on the frame of the painting. That was part of the whole Pre-Raphaelite thing that Dante Gabriel Rossetti belonged to, that we will talk a bit about, not only today, but when we do William Morris, who we'll be doing in the not-too-distant future. So do people know what Pre-Raphaelitism is in art history? Yes.
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I could explain it well, though. No
one can explain it well, but...
It's so weird, and I love it. I don't know if movement is too strong a word, because it wasn't really all that many people who were involved, but it ended up being very famous.
They call themselves the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, and they signed all their work, all their paintings, PRB. Mm-hmm. So yeah, go on.
Yeah, and it was a group that they were, I don't know, it's sort of... also tied to, again, this medievalism that became prevalent in Victorian England of, like, wanting to kind of go back to older styles, and they thought that things had gotten too stuffy, and they thought that basically the way that art had gone after Raphael was, like, just, like, not, it was moving away from what art should be. And so they wanted to kind of return to both subject matter and style that was a little more... I don't know, old-fashioned, but in a particular way. And it kind of has this, like, romantic atmosphere to it. There's a lot of focus on, like, these, like, folklore and myth-type stories. And, like, they had a lot of, like, red-headed women. And, like, there were a lot of motifs that were, like, that they emphasized. But, yeah, it's a very distinctive body of art. And it's really cool.
Yeah, and if the painting that you just looked at, if that strikes you as a style that you kind of recognize, did it for people? So the idea is basically Pre-Raphaelitism is more about painting than about poetry, but then there are the two great Pre-Raphaelite poets, if you don't count Christina Rossetti, who's the greatest of them all. And we're going to try to spend most of this week on Christina Rossetti. She is certainly the greatest female poet that England ever produced. Maybe the only greater female poet is Emily Dickinson. But she is the greatest female poet and, you know, in any reasonable list, one of the top 10 poets who ever wrote in England. Virginia Woolf has an essay on her where she talks about, Virginia Woolf just thought she was amazing. Woolf talks about a kind of conflict between the official Anglo-Catholicism, remember we talked about that last class, that Christina Rossetti subscribed to, and her actual intensity of vision and of understanding. And Virginia Woolf said that despite her desired commitment to Anglo-Catholicism, she couldn't avoid her own pre-Raphaelite eye. That is, that Christina Rossetti saw things as they were. So to explain what that means, why that's one way of describing pre-Raphaelitism, is that the pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, and she published in their journal, so even though it's Brotherhood more like guild rather than we band of brothers and you women, just forget it. Since I'm giving you a blizzard of facts, the name of their journal was where they published both paintings and poetry was called The Germ. And Goblin Market, how many people had read Goblin Market before? So we'll spend a lot of time on Goblin Market, which is just an astonishing poem. Dante Gabriel Rossetti illustrated it when Christina published it. And so there is this back and forth between the poems and the visual art. And Dante Gabriel Rossetti was best poet among the pre-Raphaelite painters and the best painter among the pre-Raphaelite poets. And he's really pretty amazing. So the basic idea, and this is, no two of them agreed. So what I'm telling you now is not anything that you can take to the bank unless it's in Silicon Valley. The basic idea is that Raphael invented a modern way of painting, of visual representation, something that is still essentially, if not the way painting works in the 20th and 21st century, the way photography works, the way film works. And I know you know what film is. The way representational visual depiction works. Not the way graphic novels work. They're a little bit more pre-Raphaelite, actually. They have a pre-Raphaelite source, interestingly enough. But the basic idea is that Raphael had an idea of painting as giving you a visual experience at a glance, which would be like your visual experience at a glance. And that's what movies do as well. That is, it's always interesting if you freeze frame a movie or if you look really closely at a great photograph, and if you're the kind of person who does this, where you're just going to look at little details that are not in the center, that are not what command your attention, that you're going to look, you're going to notice, let's say, a picture of, JFK's inaugural address. And if you're the kind of person that people who go to college are, you might, if you're looking at it long enough, just be really interested in a person off to the side whose hair has come a little bit undone and the wind is blowing in it. And you'll just get really interested in these tiny details. But they're not what the photograph's about. If you were to do a painting based on that photograph, as people do, That would not be in the painting. What would be in the painting is the general visual experience that you had, where the idea, what Raphael and his contemporaries invented, was an idea of seeing something on canvas the way you would see it psychologically in reality. So what you see on canvas, of course you can look at every tiny brush stroke and every tiny thing within it. And just because that would be different from the thing that's depicted, which is a momentary vision, you don't put all the little details that the brain filters out when it sees something just for a moment, or when you're focused on something. Yeah.
When was this, like?
16th century. So, yeah, I don't remember Raphael's exact date. Do you?
Raphael?
Yeah.
Yeah, 16th century is all I've got.
The Renaissance time.
Yeah, Renaissance.
Yeah, so this is where you get, I mean, to give an example, this is the invention of perspective. So seeing things in 3D, which was a Renaissance thing, and which was a century before Leonardo, but this is the development of modern painting. Paintings before that, visual art before that, was not three-dimensional. Didn't give you depth. Didn't aim for perspective. So if you think of, can you picture the unicorn tapestries in your mind? Mm-hmm. Anyone? Is this? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
No. Do you? No. Do you?
Kind of.
Okay, you'll recognize it as soon as I show it to you. Let's see. Can you picture any tapestries? Medieval tapestries? Okay. Here's the most famous unicorn tapestry. Oh, come on. Or one of the most famous. Okay, so is that at all familiar to you? Yeah. Okay, so look at all the little flowers before you pass it on.
It's very Garden of Earth.
Yeah, exactly. That's pre-Raphaelite. So the medieval art tapestries, some painting, although there wasn't much medieval painting, it's all about the detail. That is, that there's detail after detail after detail. What there isn't is a sense of a general impression that you're getting at a glance, mm-hmm. that deepens when you look at it. Thank you. When you look at it more and more. But what's deepening and what's so cool about this kind of painting is that it is the general impression getting deeper and deeper and deeper, rather than, oh, let's look at this like a Where's Waldo thing, where we have to look at every tiny little bit of it. What's happening is the eye is focused on something really central and important, and all the other stuff in the painting is what you would get in your peripheral vision anyhow. And even if you look at it, it's telling you, no, go look back at the center. This is really good as peripheral vision, but it's not what this painting is about. But if you think of Where's Waldo, if you think of medieval tapestries like the unicorn tapestry that I just showed you, it's every flower matters. Every tiny little thing matters. Every detail matters. There isn't this sense of a general gestalt that these things are contributing to. Each thing stands out on its own if you look at it. So it is like a collage, not of shapes, but of objects. And every little tiny thing in a medieval work of art, a medieval depiction, everything is counting. And that's a different way of perceiving a painting or a tapestry or any kind of two-dimensional visual work of art. And the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood said, no, this was great. This, what they did was great, and a huge amount was lost with the invention of modern painting. Modern meaning Renaissance and beyond. Yes, a huge amount was gained, which is, for one thing, a really good insight into the psychology of visual perception. What the Renaissance painters did was they figured out a whole lot about human visual perception, and they painted accordingly, in the same way as 20th century filmmakers from the 19-teens on figured out a whole lot about human perception of motion, and they figured it out because it worked in film. But this is a different sort of thing. So this is looking at things not as an integrated whole. They, of course, they do integrate into a whole. It's not like, oh, it's just a bunch of tiny pictures that have nothing to do with each other. They do integrate into a whole, but the details are exquisite, and every detail repays attention. So in a Renaissance painting, you're supposed to look at Mona Lisa's eyes and her mouth. And, you know, you may glance at her hands, but you're still going to be looking up towards her eyes and seeing if they follow you around the room, and towards her mouth and seeing if she's smiling or not. And one way you can, you know, Impressionism, in a sense, is the culmination of what was invented in the Renaissance. If you look at Impressionist painting, you can be amazed by the technique, but the impression is what the whole painting gives you. You don't say, oh, I wonder what kind of water lily that is that Monet is painting here. Let me get out my field guide to the water lilies of Giverny or of central France and see if I can tell by some of the veins in the water lily and also by the temperature of the water as indicated by the other flora that are growing there, exactly what kind of water lily that is. That would be to miss the Monetian point, the Monetian point. What you're doing is you're just getting the whole thing as a visual experience that fills the mind. But with Pre-Raphaelite painting, you're doing the opposite. You are looking at the amazing detail of the world. So Pre-Raphaelite painting gives you the world not as a visual whole, but as an assemblage of detail that we usually miss when we are simply seeing things as a visual whole. You look out the window and there's some trees and branches. And what a Pre-Raphaelite depiction would do is focus really brightly with lots of contrast on each patch of lichen and each branch, each bole, all the bark on all the trees. It would be more colorful because here we're just seeing it kind of as this wintry brown and gray. But in a Pre-Raphaelite painting, you would just see sharper contrast in everything, so you could see the edges, the details of everything. So that idea is one which also, interestingly, fascinatingly, doesn't go with the psychology perception, but does go with the scientific examinations that people are making in the wake of Lyell, whom we talked about. Who is he? Charles Lyell, the person who will be on the final. Lyell Finol, the geologist who figured out how old the world was. Lyell's father was Dante Gabriel Rossetti's godfather. And so there's an interesting connection between them as well. But remember, Lyell was the person that Tennyson was reading when he was thinking about writing about In Memoriam and, you know, discovering that nature is endlessly old and doesn't care about not only individuals so careless of the single life, but even of species. So one thing that Lyell did and the geologists do is they look at rocks, and what do they see? They see these tiny little animals in the rocks that no one had seen before, no one had noticed before. They take a kind of attention to minute particulars, to quote William Blake, who is against minute particulars. They attend to minute particulars, look at these tiny little particularities of the world, rather than just having the world be a single impression. It's what biologists do, what botanists in particular do. Is you look really closely at the plant, at the flower, at the stamens and pistils and cotyledons and so on. And it's that closeness of attention to detail that is the opposite of unification. Generally, the ideology of art is things should be unified. Yeats is going to put this later on. As the instruction that he tried to follow as a poet was to, quote, hammer your thoughts into unity. But when the Pre-Raphaelites take a hammer, things scatter into the original things that the alleged unity is built out of. So Pre-Raphaelites split rather than lumping. And one way of saying that is that if you look at any Pre-Raphaelite painting, if you go to a Pre-Raphaelite exhibit, look up close. Every single part of the canvas is going to be interesting. And interesting not in how it contributes to the whole, but in how that particular little thing is interesting. Just as if you look at medieval tapestries, you'll frequently see that they're little bugs that are flying around. You know, here's a unicorn, here's a virgin. The unicorn is trusting the virgin but shouldn't be, which is the story of the unicorn tapestries, the hunting of the unicorn. But just right there, you'll see a bug on a bird's wing somewhere in the tapestry. And whoever did that, that's what they were paying attention to when they wove that part of the tapestry. They're not paying attention to the virgin sitting there as the unicorn comes up to her. They're paying attention to this little thing. So Pre-Raphaelite paintings, that is how they work. So take a look at the poem. This is on page 275. Called The Wood Spurge. Which is... actually, let's see if I can get a picture of a wood spurge. I'm not sure I can. But let me try. So one thing, as I do this, to say about Rossetti, about Dante Gabriel Rossetti, is that this intense attention to detail, you could imagine that it's a mental state, it's not that different, or it is on a continuum with paranoia. That is, in the same way that one of the marks of paranoia, so here's a wood spurge. Oh, the sister said he's a wood spurge, that's hilarious. So here's what a wood spurge looks like. It is a hallmark of paranoia that the tiniest things are of significance. That is, that if someone is intensely paranoid, I don't mean paranoid because you smoke too much dope, although probably the dope you get is better, but paranoid as in everything is a sign that something is out to get me. Why did I... get a coupon in the mail today for, what is it, Blockbuster's what? What are they selling?
Lumber and flooring.
And?
Lumber and flooring.
Foreign?
Flooring.
Oh, okay. So why did I get this, given the fact that The person I think is persecuting me was wearing a Lumberjacks shirt the other day, and now I got a coupon for this Blockbuster that sells lumber. It's obvious that they're all out to get me. So that idea of overreading details, that's a hallmark of paranoia, and that's what eventually happened to Dante Gabriel Rossetti. So you can see some of this, perhaps. You can see a continuity there between his poetic interests and his psychological difficulties later in his life. But this is a really good poem. So page 275. Let's see. Let's go this way. Can you read it?
Just the first stanza?
Yeah.
The wind flapped loose. The wind was still. Shaken out dead from tree and hill. I had walked on at the wind's will. I sat now, for the wind was still.
Great. Thank you. So, what? Okay. Rhyme scheme, first of all? Yeah. Yeah. Did she just say A? I, as the Fonz would say. Yeah. Okay. The wind flapped loose, the wind was still. Interesting metaphor, right? What is the wind flapped loose, the wind was still? What's it being compared to? The wind flapped loose. What does that mean? Just those first four words. Okay, someone says the wind is flapping. What's it doing?
It's blowing hard.
It's blowing hard, and it's causing other things to flap, right? So the wind flapped loose. You can feel that the wind is causing other things to flap. Then the wind was still, so the wind stops blowing. Shaken out dead from tree and hill. What's weird about that line as a description of, as an adjectival phrase describing the wind?
That once the wind touches something else, it is dead.
Okay, once the wind touches something else, it's dead, shaken out dead from tree and hill. how is wind shaken? How does that go with the wind flapped? The wind was shaken. Shaken out dead.
He's sort of reversing where, like, instead of it being that, like, the wind is moving everything else, it's that everything else is, like, what's causing the wind to move. In some way, he's turning it on its head a bit.
Yeah. Or maybe not entirely on its head, but, okay, the last line, the wind was still. That sums up what happens in that stanza. So you could say, you know, a crude paraphrase of the stanza was, it was windy, but now the wind was still. But if you even think of the wind was still, that doesn't quite, I mean, it's a standard thing to say, and if someone says, well, the wind is still today, you're not going to say, I have no idea what you mean, that's logically self-contradictory. But if you think about it, it is, because wind is motion. Wind can't be still. It's a way of saying there's no wind. But literally it can't be true, because if there's wind, it's not still. That's the very definition of wind, is that it's moving. It's the motion of air. But what he is doing is taking what the wind does, which is to flap things, and making the wind itself what is flapped. Because it flaps, it is flapping. And because it's flapping, you can say it flaps in the same way that a sheet would flap in the wind. So the wind flaps the sheet, or the sheet flaps in the wind. So they both flap. The wind flaps, the sheet flaps. But then he takes the flapping of the sheet and applies it to the wind itself. So it's just worth noticing the slight strange, well, the very strange thing that he's saying here, but the slight strangeness of that transference of the event of flapping from what the wind would cause to flap like a sheet to the wind itself. So it's as though the wind turns into a sheet that's flapping, but is then shaken out dead from tree and hill. So it's like, okay, now the wind is dry, now we'll just hang it up and it won't move at all. I had walked on at the wind's will. What do you think that means? That's an easy line, comparatively. Yeah, I just went in the direction that the wind suggested to me. I had walked on at the wind's will. I sat now, for the wind was still. So he's walking out in the wind, but now the wind is shaken out dead from tree and hill, so it's become calm. But it's a telling metaphor to think of the wind as shaken out dead. He's not in a happy place, if that's the metaphor he uses. I sat now, for the wind was still. Leon, do the next stanza.
Between the knees my forehead was, my lips drawn in, said not alas. My hair was over in the grass, my naked ears heard the day pass.
Okay, so he's sitting there. Between my knees my forehead was, not hard, right? My lips drawn in, said not alas. So if he's not saying alas, why does that matter? None of us is saying alas except me right now saying the word. Why does it matter that he is saying that his lips were not saying alas?
Because he wasn't saying anything. He was just being silent and listening.
Yeah, but would it be different if he said, my lips drawn in said not hooray?
Who's not overly upset.
That's or at least you might expect him to say alas. He might expect himself to say alas, but he doesn't. So it's when you don't say something that when you name the very thing you don't say, you're suggesting that that would be an appropriate, an expected thing to say. And that it's interesting that he doesn't say it, presumably because he would expect to say it, because we would expect him to say it, because he's sad. So he walked on at the wind's will. Now the wind is dead, shaken out dead from tree and hill, and he sits down. And he puts his forehead between his knees. It turns out he's lying on his side in a fetal position. We're going to find out in the next line. And he just lies there and he doesn't say the alas that you or he might expect him to say. Okay, do people agree with that? I'm not going to give you the spoiler from the ambassadors. Freud has an idea called negation. In German, it's Verneinung, where he talks about the kind of analytic situation, but he says this happens in real life, where whatever is on someone's mind, they deny the very thing that is most bothering them. So an example that he gives is someone comes in and says, here's what I dreamt last night. And then after recounting their dream, the person says, so, Dr. Freud, I'm sure you're going to say that the witch in my dream was my mother, but it wasn't. And so Freud quotes the client saying that, and then he has one line. So she was his mother. So something like that, like Freudian negation, is going on here. The very thing that you don't do when you point to what you're not doing, in a sense, you're saying that is what I am doing deep down. So my lips drawn in said not alas. My hair was over in the grass. So that tells you that he's lying on his side, because his hair isn't that long that it would be on the grass if you were sitting up. My naked ears heard the day pass. What's the interesting word in that line?
Naked.
Yeah, naked ears. My ears are naked. So why does he say it? He doesn't say alas, but he does say my naked ears heard the day pass. What's the, yeah?
I mean, I personally think it's convenient in a poem reader. You need a couple extra syllables. and it all, and you know, it's one of those lines you write where you think, I found the extra two syllables and it sounds a bit poetic. But I know that, like, what we're probably supposed to take from it is, like, you know, vocal resonance of the ears being uncovered and hearing everything and not having earmuffs, like whatever, I don't know.
Yeah, my earmuffless ears heard, my muffless ears heard the day pass. Okay.
I was just thinking it might have something to do with, you know, his hear being over in the grass.
Uh-huh.
So it's almost like the hear is like, I'm imagining the speaker was really long hair. So usually their ears are covered.
Yeah, but okay,
now
good.
It's like, with the head really down, the hear is down to the grass and the ears are exposed and it's, you know, in closer contact with nature.
Yeah. Okay. So notice now that his forehead is between his knees. His lips are drawn in. His hair is in the grass. Maybe usually covers his ears, but right now. So his ears are exposed and naked. Were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say about that he's drawing contrast with his other senses that he's described, like something is interfering or interacting with everything else.
Uh-huh.
So he's trying to highlight that his ears are unobstructed.
Yeah.
As compared to like his forehead, which is kind of where his vision is.
Yeah.
And then like if his lips are drawn in, that's like another, I don't know, there's like a kind of delineation of senses here.
Yeah, good. Yeah, there definitely is. Just to return to what Quinn said, I think a standard adjective, if you just needed two syllables there, would be silent. Ears are often called silent. In a strange, it's called transferred epithet. Of course, ears are silent. It's mouths that aren't. But it's something you'll find a lot in English poetry. But naked, there is this, I think it is what Irina says, and I think that it's, there's something vulnerable about it. Quinn, you want to do the next stanza?
Sure. My eyes wide open had the run of some 10 weeds to fix upon. Among those few out of the sun, the wood's birch flowered 3 cups of one.
Okay, so now he's lying on his side, his ears are exposed, his forehead is between his knees, so he can't see a lot, right? But what does he see?
Weeds.
10 weeds.
Yeah, 10 weeds, one of which is a wood's birch. So he's focused on what's really close up.
Those eyes of his are naked too.
Sorry, his eyes are naked too, yes.
Fetal position, but yes.
Yeah, fetal position, naked eyes. And there he sees the wood spurge, 3 cups in one. Okay, Irina, do the last sentence.
From perfect grief there need not be wisdom or even memory. One thing then learned remains to me, the wood spurge is a cup of three.
Okay, so what's going on there? What's the phrase that stands out most?
Perfect grief.
Perfect grief. Yeah. So now we find out that the situation in this poem, where he's seeing the wind as shaken out dead from tree to tree, where he's going, where the wind blows him, where he lies down in this fetal position, is that he's experiencing What? Grief, perfect grief. So the occasion of the poem, to use the word that Wallace Stevens uses for what it is that makes you need to write a poem. The occasion of this poem, or the occasion of what the poem is describing, is perfect grief. It probably, I'll have to check the dates, but he had reason for great grief. So from perfect grief, there need not be wisdom or even memory. From perfect grief, there need not be wisdom. What does that mean?
You don't actually have to learn something or have a perfect memory from that moment.
Yeah, that a standard poem of grief, just think about it. A standard poem of grief is going to be one where the speaker learns something. May learn that there's nothing you can do about grief. I mean, there's plenty you can learn about grief. It doesn't make the grief worth it. You may learn that nothing makes grief worth it. But it would be a standard thing to say, I'm writing this poem because I experienced grief, and the grief became the thing that spurred me to write this poem. So if you read, you know, let's say a third of English poetry is poetry of grief. And in all cases, it's a kind of analysis of grief. It's a kind of the philosophical aspect of poetry, the psychological aspect of poetry. Yeah.
Could I add that, like, even more so, there's so much grief poetry that, like, comes with this natural image, and they're, like, supposedly, like, a robin flies by, and suddenly you get it. You understand the meaning of your grief.
Or right,
you see
beautiful.
A flower. And, like, I think that's a really smart way of writing this poem.
Yeah.
Just don't learn anything from the flower.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That it's not, there isn't a standard poetic resolution here. There isn't the kind of, well, I think that's great. Yeah, a robin flies by. That is a moment of epiphany. So what you could say is lots, do people know what the word epiphany means when applied to literature? It's actually Joyce who used it this way. So, but it's a moment where you're having a really intense experience, and then there's a moment of a kind of integration of all your experiences into an understanding of something. This is what it is. Joyce in Ulysses has Stephen Dedalus look at one of his students, who's very awkward and is smeared with ink, and Stephen thinks someone had loved him, someone had nursed his weak, watery blood with her own. Years and years I loved you, oh, my beloved, my firstborn, when you lay unborn in my womb. So that's what Stephen Dedalus is imagining this student's mother thought about him when he thinks about him. It's her son. So that thing in Ulysses was one of the earliest things Joyce ever wrote, way before he conceived of Ulysses. He wrote a bunch of fragmentary things that he, the young James Joyce, was calling epiphanies. And so this was, the epiphany was that he, Joyce, just saw a kid and had, who was kind of sloppy and a little bit gross, the way kids sometimes are. And then he suddenly realized, no, someone had loved him. Someone had nursed his weak, watery blood with her own. And he just wrote these three sentences. And it was like a discovery, an epiphany. And that's a whole lot of what lyric poetry does, is gives you that moment of epiphany. That is the aim of a whole lot of lyric poetry. But here, you're not what Rossetti is saying, and I think what Quinn is saying, Rossetti is saying, is no, it's not a moment of epiphany. So there's some terrible thing that is causing him perfect grief, but there need not be epiphany. There need not be wisdom or even memory. That is, that it's not necessarily even something that you can make an important part of your life. It's not that it's not an important part of your life. It's that it can't be what gives texture and depth to your memory. Again, it's the idea would be something like texture and depth. That's what our pasts are. And even if terrible things happen, we will want to use those terrible things as part of what gives us the depth of being human. Everyone suffers terrible things, and everyone therefore has a past which gives them depth, which makes them deep in the present. Yeah.
Not to belabor, but what do you think that he's conceiving of as perfect grief?
That good question. What do you think?
I don't know. Again, I think, like, to be honest, it sounds like
a two-syllable word.
Well, it sounds like an adjective that you put down and then it sounds good, you know?
Yeah, could be.
In a poem. But also, like, I think many poets think that their grief is perfect,
yeah.
And many other people's isn't, you know?
Yeah.
But I think I'm being maybe a little harsh on the poet.
It's interesting that you would want to be. So harsh on Rossetti.
Harsh on...
Or on other poets.
Yeah, harsh on, like, the community perception of poets. You know that they are artistic and they are deep and therefore their grief is perfect.
Yeah. Okay. Red, were you going to say something? Oh, I thought your hand was up. No.
Perfect sometimes just means complete.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
There, I'm trying to think I think there's a poem by Alvin Fineman that uses perfect in this way, but I'm not positive. It's a poem called True Night. It does mean complete. That is the perfect tense. If you know the grammar, especially if you're learning a foreign language, the perfect tense as opposed to the imperfect, is this a distinction people know? Mm-hmm. In Spanish, for example, the perfect tense is when something is over. So it's the most famous example, just to tell you, is that when Cicero says of some people who've been executed, whom he prosecuted and they've been executed, he announces their execution by saying, "They have lived," which means it's over. It is complete and finished, and there's no more. Whereas if you say, "I was living in Rome," you're still living. It's not that. So that's the imperfect tense when you describe what you were doing, but there's. It doesn't mean that that thing is over. Maybe just some stage of that thing is over.
So an imperfect grief would be watching a loved one at their death.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It also be that, especially if we're drawing a contrast here between, like, when the poet has an epiphany, that sort of brings a level of closure. This is sort of a indirect contrast to that concept of, like, you know, grief at its, you know, whatever you can call a resolution, that there really isn't necessarily a resolution that feels like an epiphany, that it's like, it just, so it's sort of almost using it in a way a little bit ironically.
Uh-huh.
Just sort of, but to an extent I think it is, because it's sort of saying that, yeah, it is drawing on that normal, like, tradition of, like, oh yes, and then it made sense and here's my solution, that's just like, no, actually that's not how it works.
Yeah, good. So memory would work the same way. I mean, there not being memory would work the same way. Something like the whole idea of memory, Rossetti seems to be saying here, the whole idea of memory is what memorials do, which is they establish something permanent as a linkage to the past, but what they're also doing is saying that thing is in the past. So it's a linkage to the past, and the thing is in the past. And, you know, just think about your parents or grandparents describing people who died before you were born. And how, you know, that's part of a background which is permanent and unchanging. And that permanent and unchanging background would mean that you're also past it, that there's your life with them, their lives now, your sense of them now, versus this thing that is in the 20th century, and which is background but not foreground. And even if they sometimes foreground it, it's nevertheless not part of their lives now, except as memory, except as perfected or perfect, complete grief, not something that's ongoing. But what he is saying is the other use of perfect, that is grief that is has nothing else combined with it, but it's just grief. It is something that you simply cannot do anything with. From perfect grief, there need not be wisdom or even memory. It's just grief. So now we know that he is in the fetal position, curled up, having some experience of perfect grief. And there is one piece of wisdom and one memory that he takes from this. One thing then learned remains to me. The Woodspurge has a cup of three. So what he's doing is lying there in perfect grief, and he doesn't tell us what it is. Comes nowhere near telling us what it is. He simply focuses on this one weed out of the sun, the Woodspurge. He notices it. And that is what he can report here. And again, that's, I think, an experience that we've had. The way Emily Dickinson puts it in one of her 1775 greatest poems is, after great pain, a formal feeling comes. That is, that the experience of pain, psychological pain, loss, mourning, misery, is, if it's great enough, she says, a formal feeling comes. You are just looking at forms, at surfaces. Depth is not what you want in great pain. What you want to do is you just notice something right here, right now, this little strange fact about the Woodspurge. It's got a cup of three. So part of this is you can feel the pain that he's feeling, or you can feel that he's feeling pain without feeling the pain that he's feeling. You can feel that he's feeling perfect grief because he's not describing it. He's not turning it into an epiphany. It's not turning into something else. It's not resolving in the way Quinn was describing. It is not something that he is thinking his way through, not something that he is, to use Freud's term again, working through. It's too much for him to work through it. And all he can do is look at the Woodspurge at that moment, be right on the surface, the visual surface of the world, and just look at the Woodspurge at that moment. And then you know, if you were to say, if you were to do a catalog of if you just went through this book, looking at the last lines of every poem, and you did a catalog of last lines from best to worst, from most powerful to least powerful. Most powerful might be from poems we've read.
It's better to have loved and lost than...
Not a last line, though.
Not a last line, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it's marked as one here.
Okay, how about Child Roland to the Dark Tower Cane?
Mm-hmm.
Totally great last line. The exact opposite of that kind of last line is the Woodsbridge has a cup of three. What lay but the dark tower itself, blind as the fool's heart, yet dauntless the slughorn to my lips I put. How much do you remember it? And blue, the Woodsbridge has a cup of three. There's Stephen King's Woodsbridge series. Has anyone read it? There's no such thing. He would never write a Woodsbridge series. That's the point. He would write a Child Roland series, a Dark Tower series, but not a Woodsbridge series. But it's really, it's intense in its absolute refusal of epiphanic intensity. It's just like, that's what he's noticing right then. Another Dickinson poem, which is similar, I think, and I think they illuminate each other, is the great poem, I Heard a Fly Buzz When I Died. So, you know that one?
Yeah, I had to read a lot of poetry last 13 years ago.
Yeah. So, for which course?
It was another poetry class, I can say.
Okay. All right, anyhow, it's the speaker. Dickinson has several poems where her speaker is dead. But this is, I heard a fly buzz when I died. So the speaker, she's surrounded by those who love her, and they're thinking about how she's dying and so on. And in the meantime, she just focuses on this trivial thing. I heard a fly buzz when I died. And the poem ends with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me. The fly is just buzzing at the window. It's trying to get out. But the window is shut. It's her sick room. With blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see. So the last thing she sees is this fly buzzing. Again, there's a kind of cinematic style where you could imagine a shot in a movie working like that. That someone is about to die, they're in the hospital, and then we get a shot of a fly, and they're noticing it just as they die. So that's what Rossetti is doing. That's what Dickinson is doing. Okay, let's look at The Blessed Damozel, which is a powerful and interesting poem. It's a little bit long, given the fact that we really, really, really need to get to Christina Rossetti, but we may go on till next week. But the situation here, as I say, is it's the point of view of the dead woman who has gone up, not to heaven, but could be going to heaven, has been summoned to heaven, has been pulled towards heaven. She's blessed. But she loves the speaker. They loved each other. And it is out of that love that she won't go straight to heaven. A thing to know is that Rossetti, who is named after Dante Alighieri, loved his namesake. And wrote about and translated Dante. His translation of La Vita Nuova is still the best. So he's also thinking of Dante here. The Blessed Damozel leaned out from the gold bar of heaven. So that's what you see in the painting that I passed around. The Blessed Damozel leaned out from the gold bar of heaven. Her eyes were deeper than the depth of waters stilled at even. She had three lilies in her hand, and the stars in her hair were seven. So that's the image. She's blessed. She's up in a Dantean heaven, Dantean paradise. Her robe ungirt from clasp to hem, no wrought flowers did adorn, but a white rose of Mary's gift for service meetly worn. Her hair that lay along her back was yellow like ripe corn. Just quickly, what's the rhyme scheme? Not that hard a question. On a scale of 1 to 5, this is 1, as far as hardness goes.
It rhymes every 2 lines.
Yeah, it's XA, XA, XA. The odd-numbered lines don't rhyme, the even-numbered lines do. One of the things we haven't had much time to talk about in this class, but there's still time, is the interplay between rhyming, between rhymed and unrhymed lines in a lot of the poets that we're doing. We didn't really look at the Mad Gardener song. There was actually, we looked at the end of it, but there's something I wanted to tell you about it. But do you remember the Mad Gardener song? He thought he saw an elephant that practiced on a fife. He looked again and saw it was a letter from his wife. At length I realized, he said, the bitterness of life. People remember that? Okay, let's look at it very briefly. I think it's the last carol poem in this selection. I think it's the last one, but I'm not sure. There was a particular thing I wanted to say about it, but we didn't get to.
212.
Page 212, great. So this is a song about a person who is deluded about everything. And it's Lewis Carroll nonsense in the sense that it's not the kind of mistake that a sensible person or a sensical person would make. He thought he saw an elephant that practiced on a fife. What does that mean? So an elephant has a fife that it's practicing on? Really? Okay, interesting image. But do you all know who Mr. Magoo is? Did you watch Mr. Magoo on VHS?
No.
Do people not know who Mr. Magoo is?
No.
Sort of, yes, sort of no. Vaguely, right, can you say?
If I'm remembering this correctly, he was a short, blind, bald man. I didn't watch much of him. I watched the Christmas special they did.
Yeah.
They did a Christmas carol with him.
Yeah, they used to show that every year. Okay, Mr. Magoo was a cartoon that you could watch after school every day if you didn't have one of these modern iPhones. And he was a person who really needed his glasses but never wore them. So he was always getting things bizarrely wrong, but the fates and God were taking care of him. So when he would walk off the edge of a cliff because he didn't see it because he was blind, luckily, a boat would be passing right then, and he could just walk over the top of the boat to the other side of the cliff. So anyhow, these were sight gags. What happens at the end of every Mr. Magoo cartoon is he would put his glasses on, and suddenly he would see what was really going on. And a friend of mine, a teacher of mine, actually in grad school took a class from the guy that Mr. Magoo was based on, who was a professor at Harvard. His name was Magoon. And he said, yeah, the cartoons kind of got Mr. Magoo right. So anyhow. Sorry?
Not like Magoon Square.
I don't think so. I don't think they're connected, but it could be. So at any rate, it's Mr. Magoo who would make a mistake like this. And for all I know, the people who did the cartoons were actually thinking of the Mad Gardener song. So, look, it's an elephant that's practicing on a fife. Do you see it? Wait a sec. Oh no, it's a text. I was wrong. It's just writing on paper. So he thought he saw an elephant that practiced on a fife. He looked again and found it was a letter from his wife. At length, I realized, he said, the bitterness of life. So first mistake he makes. Then he thinks he sees something else. He thought he saw a buffalo upon the chimney piece. So a giant buffalo on top of a chimney. He looked again and found it was his sister's husband's niece. Not a buffalo, but his sister's husband's niece. Unless you leave this house, he said, I'll send for the police. He thought he saw a banker's clerk descending from the bus. He looked again and found it was a hippopotamus. Notice the difference between 1 and 3. What are the odds that he's going to see an elephant practice on a fife? Not high. What are the odds that he's going to see a hippopotamus rather than someone who works for a bank leaving a bus? Well, apparently that's what it really turned out to be. He thought he saw a banker's clerk, or Clark, as they would have pronounced it, descending from the bus. He looked again and found it was a hippopotamus. If this should stay to dine, he said, there won't be much for us. He thought he saw a kangaroo that worked a coffee mill, because he goes to Starbucks. He looked again and found it was a vegetable pill. We've all made that mistake, right? Think you see a kangaroo working a coffee mill, but it just turns out to be vitamins, multivitamins. The 19th century version of multivitamins. Were I to swallow this, he said, I should be very ill. He thought he saw a coach and four that stood beside his bed. He looked again and found it was a bear without a head. Poor thing, he said, poor silly thing, it's waiting to be fed. He thought he saw an albatross that fluttered round the lamp. He looked again and found it was a penny postage stamp. You'd best be getting home, he said, the nights are very damp. He thought he saw a garden door that opened with a key, like in Alice in Wonderland. He looked again and found it was a double rule of three. So a double rule of three is a procedure for doing division, difficult division, actually proportions, where you're trying to see whether two things are two proportions, two ratios are the same. So it's something they taught in 19th century math. It's not taught anymore because students have no idea why it works and you're supposed to understand why it works. But a double rule of three, if you were 200 years old, you would know what it was. And all its mystery, he said, is clear as day to me. And then finally, the last stanza, he thought he saw an argument that proved he was the Pope. And what I wanted to say about that is the Pope is Alexander Pope. That is, here you can feel a little wistfulness on Carol's part, this stanza being written 12 years after the previous 7 stanzas. So an argument that he was as good a poet as Pope. He thought he saw an argument that proved he was the Pope. He looked again and found it was a bar of mottled soap. A fact so dread, he faintly said, extinguishes all hope. Okay, so now if you don't look at the poem, what you may think to yourself is that Carol is doing what he's doing, which is he's picking an elephant, a buffalo, a banker's clerk, a kangaroo, a coach and four, an albatross, a garden door, and an argument, because he's going to be able to rhyme them with something which is entirely different. So it's one of the interesting facts about rhyme, and what makes rhyme work in poetry, is that rhyme gives you chance connections between things that are not connected as to meaning. So if you say something like albatross rhymes with give a toss, it's not because albatross is give a toss about anything. It's not because when you toss things, you think about albatrosses. It's a pure accident of language that those two things rhyme. But what a poet can do, what can make poems work, the way limericks work, would be a good example. Pure accident that Nantucket rhymes with the things that it rhymes with. But then you find a way to bring them together and make those rhymes meaningful. And in comic verse, you really do that. That's why limericks work that way. If you think of any funny limerick, the rhymes are going to be two things that have nothing to do with each other, but the limerick finds a way to make them have something to do with each other so that both the story the limerick tells and the rhyme that it concludes with, they hit their marks simultaneously, and that's just great, the way they do that. So nonsense verse will really push on rhyme. So 'twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe, all mimsy. Can you do it?
All mimsy in the porticoes, and the wold rats so green.
Yeah. So slithy toves rhymes with bargroves, of course. Wabe rhymes with outgrabe. It's the rhymes that are structuring the poem, even though the rhymes themselves don't have meaning, standalone meaning. So in comic verse, in nonsense verse, lines not having standalone meaning are effective partly because of the way they rhyme with things that they shouldn't, that they don't seem to have any connection with. This is true in serious verse too, but it's most obvious in comic verse. One of the things that Carol does in the Mad Gardener song, and one of the things that we haven't been looking at but could have been throughout the course of this course already, is the experience, a readerly experience, and this is really, really interesting when it happens, a readerly experience where either we don't notice that a poem rhymes when it does, which will sometimes happen. For me, the greatest example of that, who was it who was interested in My Last Duchess? Can you recite any of it?
Oh, God.
No, that's not how it starts, sorry.
Honestly, no, and I wrote my essay about it too.
Okay, so let's just take I guess we're jumping around, but it's okay. Let's take a look at it. So actually, don't take a look. Let me just read you some of it. So it's obvious, for example, that... okay, it's... I'm not going to tell you where it is because don't read it. It's obvious, for example, that In Memoriam rhymes, right? Strong son of God, immortal love, whom those who never see thy face by love and love alone embrace, believing where they cannot prove. So we have that ABBA rhyme scheme. Or I said it when I doubted most, 'tis better to have loved and lost. Most and lost rhyming there perfectly for Tennyson, than never to have loved at all. Or Childe Roland to the Dark Tower came. If at his counsel, can you do the beginning? Okay, my first thought was, I thought you were memorizing.
Yeah, my first thought was he lied in every word, that very crippled.
With malicious eye askance to watch the working of his lie on mine, and mouth scarce able to afford suppression of the glee that pursed and scored his lips and one more victim gained thereby. Okay, so word and afford, glee, person scored and scored, thereby and lie, to watch the working of his lie on mine. At one more victim gained, to watch the working of his lie on mine, at one more victim gained thereby. So we really hear the rhymes there. Okay, so here's My Last Duchess, which we didn't get a chance to talk about, but we have 2 minutes, so that should be plenty. Not. So Ferrara, the Duke of Ferrara, is speaking, and he is pointing out a painting of his late wife, to an emissary from someone else who wants to marry his daughter off to the Duke of Ferrara if they can come to a good deal about the dowry. So that's my last duchess painted on the wall, looking as if she were alive. I call that piece a wonder now. Frau Pandel's hands worked busily a day. And there she stands. Will it please you sit and look at her? I said, Frau Pandolf, by design. For never read strangers like you that pictured countenance, the depth and passion of its earnest glance. But to myself they turned, since none puts by the curtain I have drawn for you but I, and seemed as they would ask me, if they durst, how such a glance came there. So, not the first are you to turn and ask thus. Sir, 'twas not her husband's presence only called that spot of joy into the Duchess's cheek. Perhaps Frau Pandolf chanced to say, her mantle laps over my lady's wrist too much, or paint must never hope to reproduce the faint half flush that dies along her throat. Such stuff was courtesy, she thought, and cause enough for calling up that spot of joy. She had a heart, how shall I say, too soon made glad, too easily impressed. She liked whate'er she looked on, and her looks went everywhere. Sir, 'twas all one, my favor at her breast. The dropping of the daylight in the west, the bough of cherry some officious fool broke in the orchard for her. The white mule she rode with round the terrace, all and each would draw from her alike the approving speech or blush, at least. She thanked men. Good, but thanks somehow, I know not how, as if she ranked my gift of a 900 years old name with anybody's gift, etc. It's most of it, but we don't have time. Lots of people don't notice that poem rhymes, but it's all rhymed couplets. And what Browning does is through enjambment, through where phrases end, where the intense words are, he disguises the fact that it's rhyming. But the rhymes are wall, call, hand, stand, said, read, countenance, glance, by, eye, etc. So rhymed couplets are the hardest things to disguise, but lots of people don't notice the poem rhymes. More interesting still, we'll pick up on this on Wednesday, but read Goblin Market, which really rhymes. But more interesting still are poems that you remember as rhyming that don't. And one of those is, which we also looked at, is the poem Tithonus, which the last line is, and thou returning on thy silver wheels. And everyone thinks that's a rhymed line if you ask them. But nothing in Tithonus rhymes. It just feels like it does. Okay, so the thing about the Mad Gardener's song is Carol is not picking things and juxtaposing them because they rhyme. They don't rhyme. The rhyme scheme is XA, 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 and it's the X's that contain the elephant that practiced on a fife. It is elephant doesn't rhyme with anything. All the things that the Mad Gardener thinks he sees, Banker's Clerk, etc., none of those things rhyme with the things that they turn out to be. Ask the next person you see, the Mad Gardener's song, do you think the things that the Mad Gardener thinks he sees rhyme with the things they really turn out to be? And the answer is no. It's not like he thought he saw an insect that he thought was the bee's knees. He looked again, and it turned out to be the exhaust from a sneeze. It's not, that's not what he's doing. What Carol is doing is taking things that don't rhyme at all, but you kind of think they're rhyming because they're so outrageous. I'm saying this because Rossetti does the same thing in The Blessed Damozel, and it's a surprise that he would, but he does. Okay, we'll talk about it very briefly again on Wednesday, but we'll talk mainly about Christina Rossetti, especially Goblin Market. Okay, see you Wednesday.
No more.